The T-Biz podcast delivers tea news that you need to know. A recap of the week's major headlines with commentary and cultural trends hosted by Dan Bolton. It is the voice of origin for tea professionals and enthusiasts worldwide.
Each year, the T-Biz portal publishes the State of the Tea Industry Forecast, a forward-looking assessment of production, pricing, trade, and demand. We invite tea professionals across the value chain to review the findings and contribute their perspective. Your insights help refine the forecast before it is finalized on March 1st.
Hello, everyone. Here are this week's headlines. Middle East instability is threatening blending hubs. A refund rush is underway in U.S. trade. And China's U.S. ambassador praises tea harmony. Plus, regenerative tea moves from sustainability claims to farm-level economics. Later in the program, Tea Rebellion founder Annabelle Palmer joins us on Earth Day to explain how Regen Tea is testing whether soil health can translate into measurable return on investment for tea producers. It's a shift from certification to economics, and one that could redefine how value is created at origin. More in a minute. But first, this important message.
What makes a perfect cup of Ceylon tea? The perfect cup is from the tea businesses that ensure the protection of all the children living within their tea estates. We salute Keilani Valley, Telawakili, Bogawanthalawa, Harana, and Eliptia tea estates. Support Save the Children, Sri Lanka.
The disruption to Gulf shipping is now measurable, and for the tea trade, timing is the issue. Traffic through the Strait of Hormuz, a corridor that typically handles more than 120 vessel transits per day, fell to single digits at the peak of disruption in April. As May begins, flow remains uneven, with carriers suspending or rerouting services. For tea, that shift moves quickly from logistics into operations. The global tea trade depends on cadence. Auction cycles in Colombo, Mombasa, and North India feed directly into shipping schedules, which then determine blending and re-export timelines. When that cadence breaks, the system slows. At the center of that system is the Dubai Multi-Commodity Center, one of the world's most important tea aggregation and blending hubs. Roughly 150 to 200 million kilos of tea move through Dubai each year, and most of that is re-exported. Bulk shipments from India, Sri Lanka, and East Africa are blended and packed and distributed to Europe, Central Asia, Russia, and the Middle East. It's an efficient system, but it depends on schedule integrity, and that's where the pressure is building. Shipping delays into Dubai are now extended by 2 to 3 weeks in some cases. Blenders are adjusting formulations based on available stock, having to stagger production runs and increase inventory buffers to compensate. The issue is not whether tea is moving, it's whether it's arriving on time. At the same time, instability in the Red Sea continues to extend global shipping timelines. Attacks on commercial vessels have forced many carriers to reroute away from the Suez Canal, adding 10 to 15 days to transit times via the Cape of Good Hope. Major container lines, including Maersk and Hapag-Lloyd, say schedule reliability has deteriorated as vessels reroute around high-risk zones, with longer transit times now forming the baseline. For tea shipments moving from India or East Africa, this creates a compounded delay, longer transit into Dubai, followed by tighter blending and re-export windows. Costs are rising as well. War risk insurance premiums have increased several fold for vessels transiting high-risk corridors, and freight volatility for tea remains elevated, translating into higher landed costs, particularly in bulk segments where margins are already tight. But for most operators, timing, not cost, is the immediate constraint. Blending hubs operate on throughput. Retail demand cycles are fixed. When shipments arrive late, the result is missed delivery windows, compressed margins, or delayed distribution. Against that backdrop, operators in Dubai are emphasizing continuity. Gary Winslade, Associate Director of T at DMCC, said, quote, "Despite current market uncertainty, the DMCC T-Center's focus is on continuity. Demand remains steady and members are well-stocked. Periods like these underscore the importance of diversified trade routes, strong commercial relationships, and operational agility," he said. That reference to inventory is important. Dubai entered this period with relatively strong stock positions, which are now helping absorb delays. At the same time, the DMCC Tea Center has expanded its teabagging capacity, an indication that demand for value addition processing remains strong. In effect, Dubai is functioning as a buffer. The broader issue is structural. The tea trade has long been optimized for efficiency, centralized blending, lean inventories, and predictable logistics. That model still works, but it's being repriced. Higher inventory levels mean higher working capital. Delays reduce re-export velocity. Smaller traders, especially those reliant on short-term financing, are more exposed than large multinational operators. At the same time, variability at origin is increasing. Weather patterns in India and Kenya are affecting supply consistency, adding pressure upstream that compounds at the blending stage. The response across the trade is measured. Inventory buffers are increasing and shipping schedules are being adjusted, and contracts are becoming more flexible. There is some movement towards origin-based packing for specific products, but it remains limited at this time. What's clear is that the structure of the trade is not changing, but the way it operates is. Dubai's role is not weakening, it's becoming more defined. It's no longer just a transit point, it's a coordination layer holding inventory, adjusting blends, and maintaining continuity across multiple markets. Operators like DP World have emphasized route diversification and integrated logistics as key to maintaining throughput under disruption, and that's exactly what we're seeing in the tea sector. Business Insight. 60 days into the conflict, the system is still functioning, but at a higher cost in terms of certainty. Longer transit times, higher insurance costs, and increased inventory requirements are now part of the operating environment. For tea companies, the takeaway is straightforward. Supply chains must be designed to absorb delay, not just minimize cost. And in that shift, hubs like Dubai are becoming more, not less, important. A refund rush is underway in U.S. trade. Importers and custom brokers have filed about 75,300 CAPE declarations, covering more than 11.2 million individual import entries since U.S. Customs and Border Protection opened the first phase of its tariff refund system on April 20th. That figure is not 11 million companies, it's 11.2 million entry claims, but the scale is still extraordinary. CBP filings indicate more than 330,000 importers paid about $166 billion in IEPA duties across roughly 53 million entries. The rush follows the U.S. Supreme Court's February 20th ruling that the president lacked authority to impose sweeping tariffs under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. Reuters reports that the first refunds could begin arriving around May 11th, but by late April, only 21% of affected entries had been accepted for duty removal, and only 3% had reached the refund stage. That means the money's not moving as quickly as the headlines suggest. Phase one applies only to certain unliquidated and recently liquidated entries. Sidley notes that CBP is excluding several categories from immediate processing, including reconciliation entries, drawback entries, and some USMCA duty deferred entries as entries tied to AD and CVD review. Valid refunds may take 60 to 90 days after CAPE acceptance, according to Sidley Austin. The legal risk remains unresolved. Abasto reports that the Court of International Trade entered a refund order on April 7th, but suspended immediate compliance, leaving room for further appeal. In plain English, it means that importers are filing now to preserve their claims, but the refund pipeline can still be slowed, narrowed, or contested in court. Most companies are already treating refunds as balance sheet events. General Motors expects a $500 million refund, while UPS said it collected about $5 billion in tariffs from customers and will issue refunds once the Treasury remits the funds. FedEx made a similar pledge. Business Insight. For tea, the refund story is not a consumer rebate story. Most refunds will flow first to the importer of record, the broker, the parcel carrier, and a larger corporate supply chain account. Some funds may reduce future wholesale costs, repair margins, or offset new tax exposure, but very little is likely to appear as a refund on a consumer's tin of tea. The practical advice for tea companies is simple. Document the entries, file correctly, preserve claims, and do not promise retail price relief until the cash is in hand. In two official statements issued by the Embassy of the People's Republic of China in the United States this week, China's ambassador used tea as a cultural and economic bridge, emphasizing its role in fostering dialogue, trade, and mutual understanding between the two countries. The language is deliberate. Tea is framed not only as heritage, but also as a living channel for cooperation at a time when broader trade relationships remain strained. The ambassador highlighted tea's 2,000-year history, its role in global exchange, and its continued relevance in modern commerce. That's not new. What is notable is the timing. These remarks come amid escalating tariffs, regulatory friction, and supply chain realignment between the U.S. and China, conditions that have already pushed cumulative U.S. tariffs on Chinese tea at one point above 100%. So why tea and why now? Because tea is one of the few categories in which U.S. and Chinese cultural diplomacy and commercial realities still intersect. Unlike rare earth elements, semiconductors, or EVs, tea carries symbolic weight without triggering immediate security concerns. It's soft power, but with hard trade implications. China is signaling openness, but the market is still signaling more than a share of caution. U.S. importers are not expanding their exposure to Chinese origin tea at scale right now. Instead, they are diversifying into India, Sri Lanka, and Kenya, and increasingly into African origin specialty teas that may benefit from new zero tariff access to China. So the ambassador's remarks should be read less as a market shift and more as positioning consistent with China's newly adopted five-year plan to boost tea exports. Business Insight. Diplomatic praise does not override the reality of tariffs. Until trade policy changes, Chinese tea remains structurally disadvantaged in the U.S. However, the signaling matters. If tensions ease, even marginally, tea could be one of the first categories to normalize. For now, importers should treat China as a selective, high-value origin, not a volume play, while closely monitoring policy signals. The Week 17 Tea Price Report for the period ending April 24th is sponsored by the East Africa Tea Trade Association, EATTA, owners of the Mombasa Tea Auction since 1956. Tea markets closed Week 17 with prices edging firmer across the major auction centers, but the underlying signal remains quality, not volume. Across Colombo, North India, Mombasa, and Indonesia, buyers continued to participate, but with discipline. Competition focused on clean, well-manufactured teas needed for immediate blending and export commitments. Secondary grades remained more difficult to secure, requiring price adjustments or weaker bidding. Pricing reflects that structure clearly. In Colombo, prices averaged $3.24 per kilo, up 3 cents week on week, North India averaged $1.92 per kilo, up 4 cents on the last available official benchmark. Mombasa came in at $2.23, up 2 cents on the prior sale, while Indonesia averaged $2.44 per kilo, also up 3 cents on an indicative basis. The structural backdrop remains important. Stable currencies in Sri Lanka and Kenya, cost pressure from freight and energy, and lower crop signals in selected origins are limiting downward price flexibility. At the same time, there is no sign of speculative buying. This is still a market governed by need, quality, and execution. The takeaway is straightforward. Global tea prices are firming modestly, but not because buyers are chasing volume. They compete on quality that justifies the price. That's the TE Business Price Report for Week 17, ending 24 April 2026. Subscribe for free to the TBiz newsletter on LinkedIn for a detailed regional breakdown, 6-month trade signals, and a near-term outlook for quarter two pricing dynamics. And now, a word from this week's sponsor.
Hello, I'm Bogdan, a passionate tea drinker and the inventor of the ultimate tea machine, the Brewmaker One. Preparation is key to making fine tea. Sequential steepings deliver the best taste possible and unlock the true value of whole leaf teas and botanicals. Brew automates that process without using any pots or capsules. This simple-to-operate smartphone-controlled device stores steeping profiles to consistently make great tea at the push of a button. Brew also reduces time, waste, and energy. That's because I engineered the brew to remember control settings for temperature, brewing time, and quantity. Using my patented process lets you stack steeps simply and conveniently.
On Earth Day, it's easy to talk about sustainability in broad terms, but much harder to connect those ideas to what's happening on the ground. For tea producers, climate pressure is no longer abstract. It's showing up in yield, cost, and long-term viability. What we're exploring today is a different approach, one that attempts to measure soil health, biodiversity, and resilience, and link those directly to economic outcomes. Annabelle Calmer is the founder of Tea Rebellion and a trustee of Regen Tea, a UK-based foundation advancing regenerative agriculture in the tea industry. She works with origin partners across Africa and Asia and is leading a multi-country pilot focused on farm-level data and soil health. Thank you so much, Annabelle, for joining us on the Tea Biz podcast. It's Earth Day, something I personally celebrate since the very first Earth Day, which I took part in so many years ago. It's a delight to see you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and it's a pleasure to be back. And especially today, given that it's Earth Day, you know, just everything we can do to get attention to the what we're working on this particular day, which should be every day, frankly.
Annabelle, the tea industry has invested heavily in sustainability certification. What prompted you to move beyond that system and build Regen Tea?
So the origins to this are really kind of my visits to our partner farms. We now have 8 tea partners with Tea Rebellion that we work with, and visits to Malawi, Nepal, Tanzania spurred the awareness that that certificate compliance today is really a double-edged sword for many farmers because of the increasing complexity of it, the increasing costs, and the increasing kind of overburdening of the farmer with that part of the requirement, given the food system need for transparency, safety, and everything else. And so there's also the increased interest in transparency in the food system in terms of knowing where it actually comes from. And of course, we have global commitments with climate COPs, biodiversity COPs, land degradation COP, and I think they're all happening at the same time this year. So that really kind of that backdrop gave rise to the Regenerative Tea Action Project, which was the precursor of this. And then there's the technology side of it, the opportunity that is presented by farmer-centric tracking of outcomes and monitoring that really we didn't have. I think in the 70s and the 80s, this is completely new, and it presents an opportunity to change how things happen today, the status quo, I think, on this whole sustainability question, away from complicated audits to just seeing the information right on your screen with the right tools.
Regent is involved into a foundation with a broader mandate. What does that structure enable?
Turned it into a foundation. We have three trustees, Michael Hamm from Wild Orchard, Bernardine Kay from Esther, and myself. And we're committed for 3 years to be trustees. And it's incorporated as a charitable incorporate organization, which is CIO in the UK. There's such a backlog that we're still waiting for the formal approval tick. It's been months, but everyone is in a backlog. The government is very behind in approving foundation creation in the UK. We set it up as a foundation because there was really the sense of that if we want to be make lasting change in the sector, we have to change our structure and make it more permanent. It's allowed us to really kind of move away from Tiber Bellion being the creator and it's kind of very attached to my personal brand to being something that's industry wide and allows other tea brands to just, you know, to really shape it as well, which is important. And then it allowed us to bring on board a lot of volunteers. And I think that is easier if you have a foundation. It's very hard to justify if you have a corporate structure, even if, you know, no matter how impact focused, it really becomes odd to have that many volunteers around, I think. It's enabling us to do fundraising. We are at the early stages of that, and we have a crowdfunding campaign live today to raise the initial seed money for this foundation. But it will really help us when we are going out to donors, going out to green tech, going out to others, philanthropists who want to help support and make this change happen. And then the final one is it allowed us to partner more effectively with the Regenerative Organic Alliance, which are an amazing organization really spearheading regenerative agriculture, as well as finding our technical partner, Landprint, for the DMRV, Digital Monitoring, Reporting and Evaluation Validation System that we have.
You've launched a multi-origin pilot. What are you actually measuring at the farm level?
So I think I have to say as a caveat that we're quite early in the process. We literally just signed the contract with Landprint, the tool provider. So we have 11 to 15 pilotees in this process. And I think in terms of the philosophical approach for the pilot is that it's very much farm-level data intelligence, trying to empower farmers, producing regenerative, documenting regenerative outcomes, but also data that gives agronomic resilience or information about actual farming level data. And it's a combination of kind of basic remote information. So if you think about, you've heard of Bumitra, right? The Indian startup, amazingly successful company that's doing this for soil carbon data, basically remote monitoring of soil carbon retention and thereby paying farmers for it. So this is an expanded, conceptually, if you think about it, expanded idea of not just looking at carbon, but also looking at, so obviously carbon stock is included, soil cover, water in the soil and crop health. That's remotely sensed through, we call it polygons. So basically it's the footprint of a field. Yeah, so the dimensions, geo coordinates of a field that gets uploaded into the data system. And then the farmer has the option to enhance that with ground truth or ground data to make sure that that information actually is, well, leveled up, more intelligent, has some ground truth in it. And that's something that will enrich that remote data in the same kind of spectrum, soil, carbon, water, biodiversity, resilience, and then also agricultural practices. So one area that is where we need to be quite focused is we need to focus the pilot in the first year on a couple of practices so that we can then walk away and say, look, what did we actually learn from these practices? Because of course, there's a lot going on and it's important that we focus what we ask the farmers to change onto something that we can then actually say something about. So at the moment, it looks like everyone is very interested in looking at alternative fertilizers. So whether it's composting, whether it's liquid fertilizer, whether it's charcoal, biochar, or whether it's nitrogen fixing plants that are intercrop or anything like that. So basically the idea of sustaining and enhancing yields with alternative ways beyond chemical fertilizers, of course, is an area that most of the farms have said that they're interested in. So we're thinking of focusing the practices change or the practice discussion on that in the first year. But generally, in terms of like the data that we want to show, we're focusing on what practice change has a measurable ROI on the farm. That's what we want to get at the end. And what yield drop is can be expected for how long and when will that kind of be offset by resilience in the system and better soil health.
How do you demonstrate that regenerative practices deliver real economic value?
I think it's important to help people understand that this is not a fluffy sustainability initiative, right? This is an initiative that is looking at addressing also risk factors in farming, building resilience, and increasing agronomic benefit to the grower. So it's an economic benefit. So this is not about, you know, something that you can, like, you know, a carbon neutral batch that goes on your website. It's not that level of depth. It really is something completely different. When we asked the farmers about what they're most interested in getting out of it, they said agronomic benefits, right? So higher yields, and saving costs and sustainable kind of, I'm using them with the S word again, but what I mean is the better production at a lower cost, basically. Yeah. And so the way that we want to visualize that and show that is by working, and I think this is why we've chosen a partner that is quite in tune with the TNFD process and the risk and land degradation as to like the nature risks that's out there and the land degradation as one that people are increasingly aware of, and that also being soil degradation, because of course the farmer's main asset is the soil. So I think that is a shift in perspective and an important one. You know, if we can help farmers, if we can help document the return on investment for the farmer from doing regenerative practices by increasing the asset value of their soil, of their forest, of, you know, and the market price for their tea, then this will have been a fantastic initiative.
What does success look like if this works at scale?
We want to build the evidence base, develop funding mechanisms, and build a knowledge network, right, around regenerative. So those are the three kind of, let's say, three pillars of it. And that requires us working with a lot of other parties in order to make that happen. So if you think about being able to develop something like a digital region passport that shows the information of each farm in terms of carbon, moisture, biodiversity, the practices, kind of really embody that, and the farmer owning that and sharing that with their buyers or their partners or the certifiers, those people that they trust and they want to work with. If that is the first level of kind of information sharing and transformation at the farm level, then we want to, in 10 years or 5 years time already, be at the position where we can put a revenue generation kind of pillar on top of that, which would give a farm a benefits for having created these, let's say, these asset value or this impact, these outcomes through a market. Yeah. And we call them impact units. So somehow creating, getting paid for having created impact units on the farm. And then thirdly, there is the whole kind of halfway of getting certified and also the market kicking in for actually being able to pay higher prices for an amazingly regeneratively organic grown tea. Right. That will take some time. And we are all aware that in the transition period, the market isn't quite ready to yet fully pay for this and compensate, and that the farmers need to be supported for a number of years in that transition. But that is kind of the pathway. First, the transformation at the farm level, then some impact payment, economic benefits for what's being created, and then thirdly, being certified and then the market compensating for it. And that requires us to work with a whole lot of different parties to make that happen in terms of funding mechanism, in terms of certification, ROA, as I've mentioned. But that is the aim. So if we you know, we really want to help transform how that all works. And by 2035, that's actually, well, where are we? 2006. So that's more than 5 years. By 2035, we want to have 10,000 hectares that have transitioned under this verified regenerative process that we are working on, basically, with partners.
So how can producers and buyers get involved?
There are different ways to get involved. So let's say you are a farm and you're listening to this and you are interested in learning more about regenerative farming. You're learning, you want to see, get inspired by other farms who are already ahead of you in the journey. You want to understand how certification might work. You want to understand what the costs might be to be involved, or just broaden your horizon on this. So I invite you to join RegenT in that case. It is a free membership for the first year at least. We're building that site. If it's not live yet when you look, then it would be under T Rebellion Learn. There's a tab for people to join there. It should be a pop-up window. And then for others who want to support this change, or also farms who want to make sure RegenT becomes a sustainable organization and helps us to interim fund, we have this crowdfunding campaign, which is live right now on Earth Day. And then the aim is to raise initially 2,000, but then £5,000. And that will bridge us over until we have proper funding, help us to pay the digital technical provider and help us just IT costs. Because I think value chain partners are hugely important, and we might not have enough of them in the project right now. We have mostly buyers, you know, like more boutique retailers and farmers in there right now. And it would be probably quite helpful to have packers, importers, you know, blenders, everyone in the supply chain involved, I think.
It's Earth Day, and you're promoting the Earth. Give me a statement on why that symmetry makes sense.
If you're in doubt what Earth means to us, just go for a walk in the green. You know, just get out there, listen to birds, see the green for 10, 15 minutes, you know, get off your phone, and you'll already see what it does for you. I mean, the impact is immediate in terms of our well-being and our resilience as humans. and that's the evidence everyone needs. You just get out there, you see how important it is, because we don't want to be so abstract. I think we get huge pleasure and nourishment and enrichment from Earth or natural assets every single day. And we need to remind ourselves that that is what's at stake.
Annabelle Calmer on RegenT, an effort to move beyond compliance and towards measurable outcomes at origin. Intrigued by what you heard in today's podcast? Would you like to learn more from our global network of T-Biz journalists and T-experts? Remember to visit the T-Biz website for more comprehensive coverage. That's www.t-biz.com. Thanks for listening. Farewell till next week.
Produced by Atavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.